Hello, this is Gil Meggerly, the co-host of the national radio series Focus on the Family, featuring psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson. It's our privilege to share with you on this cassette some conversation taken from two recent Focus on the Family broadcasts in which Dr. Dobson was answering some letters from his constituents. Particularly, he had pulled together letters from parents of teenagers and attempted in addressing some of the questions they raised to offer a little help to those of us involved in leading the adolescent through that period of life. With that as background, let me invite you to sit back and enjoy some conversation between Dr. James Dobson and myself about teenagers. Doctor, we want to devote this program today to letters we've received from a rather exclusive group of parents. Why don't you begin by describing that group to our listeners?
Gil, that's a special club. They're letters that have come from parents of teenagers. And in that sense, they're all sort of like war buddies because they've been involved in combat duty of one sort or another.
They have. That's a good place to start. We joke a lot about that, that it's tough raising a teenager. But what's at the bottom of that? Why can't parents and kids just be friends and avoid all that scratching and clawing?
Oh, Gil, I don't know, really. How come I get a cold three times a year?
I don't know that either.
It's just in the nature of things. 12 to 20 can be a very, very frustrating time of life.
It's like a cycle, isn't it? You start off with your children as close friends, and then you go through that war zone, and who knows how to define that relationship, and then it comes back again. After college and marriage, you're back to being friends again.
Gil, part of the irritation comes from the fact that one of your primary tasks in parenthood is to civilize your kids. You know, you take this wild little toddler who knows no limits and no boundaries, and you try to teach him to eat with a spoon and to leave the doggy's water alone and not to stick his head in the toilet bowl and to leave daddy's toothbrush alone and so on. And a little later, you try to work on him to get him to hang up his clothes and to make his bed and to put the napkin in his lap and to say please and thank you and all these kinds of civilized behavior. And most importantly, you try to teach him to speak respectfully to his elders and to obey and to cooperate and to be pleasant and all that.
And if you're successful, sometime around age 6, 7, 8, 9, you begin to see the fruits of that.
That's right. Perhaps by 11, at least, when you think you've just about gotten that message across, then he goes into adolescence and he forgets everything you've taught him. And he becomes sloppy beyond description, and his voice is loud and bellowing. There's not a subtle bone in his body anyplace, and he gets clumsy and ungraceful for a period of time, and he eats the most horrible foods. You know, you spend all this time teaching him to eat his vegetables and to not eat too much sugar and all these kind of things, and then he goes into adolescence, and it's hot dogs and hamburgers, and he absolutely slaughters the King's English. You know, for 12 years you've taught him to use proper grammar, and he forgets all about that. He can be more rude and disrespectful during that time than he's ever been in his entire life, and he becomes incredibly selfish again, just like he was when he was a toddler. He honestly believes, Gil, that the rest of the family ought to drive him where he wants to go and cook his meals and iron his clothes and give him money and ask absolutely nothing from him. So it really is very frustrating to put all this effort into the civilizing process of the first 12 years and then all of a sudden to feel like you have failed in every single thing you tried
right.
to do.
You know, I suppose it's good to be able to laugh about it in the context of talking about it as you just have. But the truth of the matter is it produces a great deal of anxiety for parents, doesn't it?
It does. And the classic response of parents, of course, is to nag the kids half to death during that time, which makes it uncomfortable for the youngster, too, going through this. But it just looks like all those years of training has gone down the drain for a period of time.
That's right. Maybe we should ask, do those years of training actually go down the drain for that period?
Probably not, Gil. Adolescence is a period of transition, and all of life is composed of what's called periods of equilibrium and periods of disequilibrium. Equilibrium refers to relative calm and adjustment. Disequilibrium, obviously, is the opposite, referring to a temporary lack of balance when things don't work out quite so well. Well, adolescence is a temporary period of disequilibrium that can be very disconcerting for both generations, but it is temporary, and normality will return if you can just hang on. I heard an illustration the other day that sounds, I think, very accurate to me. In some ways, the adolescent years can be thought of as a seed that's planted in the ground. before anything has come up. And you may begin to wonder if the seed has died and if there's no future for it. It's forgotten. It's gone. It's not seen. But it's still alive, and it is still growing underneath the ground. And if you water it and give it plenty of sunshine and give it a little bit of time, then the little green shoot begins to come up in late adolescence and in the early 20s. And who knows, maybe you'll have a flowering plant again.
I hear a chorus of parents out there saying, the seed died.
The water doesn't do any good.
Oh, those are rough years. Listen, you were mentioning a moment ago that a lack of social grace, rudeness, is often a part of what we're talking about. You know, I've noticed one thing about teenagers I'd love to hear your comment about, and that is, have you noticed how often they have absolutely nothing to say when you approach them?
Gil, part of that nonverbal tendency results from a lack of confidence during adolescence, you know, especially during the junior high years, where those enormous questions are being asked about who am I and who really cares and what's my place and do I fit in and are they laughing at me behind my back? And will I be able to compete in this life? And do I have a place? Do people really care about me? And until those questions are answered, there's a tendency to be very reticent to do the safe thing, which is to pull into a shell and pull down a curtain and not allow anybody to see behind your eyes. Therefore, there's very little in the way of verbal interchange. Now, I think we should not panic during this time because, again, it's this period of disequilibrium. It's a normal process that they come through. But I'd like to make a suggestion to our listeners, not only for those that have adolescence in that nonverbal time, but also for younger children. One of our listeners sent me an article that was in the Woman's Day magazine on February 17, 1980. It was an article called Teaching Your Child the Art of Conversation by Sybil Ferguson. Gil, it's very brief, and I'd like to read it to our listeners now because I think this is tremendous.
Good, and the point of it is this is an idea for how to get our kids to talk.
That's right, to make them sensitive to the dynamics of conversation. Ella Weber had just left for an afternoon of coffee and conversation. She had tried without much success to talk to my shy son, Jimmy. I decided he needed help in learning how to carry on a conversation. I picked up 3 tennis balls from the hall closet and went into the family room. "Jimmy," I said, "let's play a game. I have 3 tennis balls. I'll throw you one and you throw it back, okay?" Jimmy nodded a bit suspiciously, and I tossed him 1 ball. He tossed it back. "Now this time when I throw it," I said, "you keep it." I threw the ball. Jimmy was beginning to think that he had a screwball mother, but he went along with me. He caught the ball and held it. "Put it in your lap," I said. "Here comes another. Keep this one too." I threw the 2nd ball and he kept it. "Now here's the last one." He caught the 3rd ball and kept it. We sat there for a moment silently. "Not much of a game, is it?" I asked. "Aw, Mom, what do you want me to do?" "I want you to realize that if you don't throw the ball back, nothing happens. We aren't playing." "Anybody knows that," he said. "Okay," I said. "It's the same with talking to people. When they throw you a subject, you have to throw one back." "What?" he said. "Remember when Mrs. Weber asked you about school? You said it was okay. She asked you if you had a nice birthday last week, and you said yes. Then she asked if you liked to play baseball, and you said yes. You were very polite, but you kept all the balls." I pointed to the 3 balls in his lap. "Aw, Mom." "Well, you did. What could you have thrown back when she asked about school?" "I don't know," he wriggled. "How about telling her one thing that happened? The teacher read a story. You had chili for lunch. You learned about the post office. Just one thing tosses the ball back. Catch on?" "Yeah, sort of," he grinned at me. "Let's try. Did you have a nice birthday last week?" I said, playing Mrs. Weber. "Yeah, I had chocolate cake and ice cream." "Good." I hugged him. "That was a good toss. Now maybe she'll tell you about her best birthday or something great she had to eat. You see, you gave her a chance to throw another ball back. Now how about, do you like to play baseball?" "Huh?" "If someone asks you if you like to play baseball, what do you toss back?" "Well, I like to play first base." He looked at me questioningly. "Fine, that gives the other person a chance to talk about first base, or a game he saw, or why he actually likes basketball better. Do you see how it works?" Kind of, yeah. Good. Just remember to answer the question and tell one more thing. It always works, okay? Okay. The next guests were business acquaintances of my husband. When introduced to Jimmy, they asked the inevitable question, how's school? Fine. Jimmy glanced at me, paused, and said abruptly, I got 100 in spelling. One man let the ball drop. Good for you, he said. But the other man played the game right. 100? I'm a terrible speller. I always have to look up words in the dictionary, and that isn't easy if you don't know how to spell them. But I was always pretty good at arithmetic. Do you get 100s in arithmetic, too? Jimmy was generous with this adult who couldn't spell. Not always, he said. I don't like word problems. The man had a word problem puzzle. This time the second man came through with a riddle. Then Jimmy asked a riddle, and the encounter with two strangers passed smoothly. My shy Jimmy had learned to toss the ball back.
Oh, what a fabulous idea.
Isn't that beautiful? And, Gil, I have tried this. This is not just a suggestion on paper, but I have tried it with my own son and daughter. And they both got the idea very quickly, and they even talk about tossing the ball back.
Were you having some of the same problems? They were a little shy with strangers?
I think every child goes through this. So there are some very, very verbal kids who can just talk to a fence post. But especially as they approach adolescence, the latter end of the first stage of childhood, conversation is an art that has to be learned. And this is an excellent little device for teaching them to tune in to what the other person is fishing for when they ask these dumb questions like, how's school and do you like baseball?
You know, now that you mention it, I know some adults that aren't all that good about tossing the ball back either. We could all learn something from that. We've got some letters with us now from some of our listeners. That really is why we got into this whole subject, because some of our listeners are struggling with this very issue.
Gil, for some time now, I've been collecting cards and letters that have come from parents of teenagers, and I've been putting them in a special file for this broadcast today. And what I want to do now is deal with some of those letters one by one and try to provide some answers to the questions that are asked.
You show me some of those letters, and I have the distinct impression that being the father or mother of a teenager is a real job.
You're going to find that out in about 5 years.
That's right. I'm not there yet.
It often involves every human emotion at one time or another, and especially feelings of guilt. There's something about the latter end of childhood that emphasizes our failures as parents. And whenever that subject comes up, I'm reminded, of course, of Dr. John White, whom we had as a guest on this program some time ago.
A psychiatrist with the University of Manitoba had written a book on the subject, a tremendous influence.
Yeah, as you remember, Gil, we had just a great volume of mail after he'd been on the program. He's the author of the book, Parents in Pain. I refer to that book often because I think it has a powerful message that all parents should hear, especially those who are having struggles with their teenagers. But after he was on, we received a fantastic letter that I have in front of me from a mother who's given me permission to share it with our listeners. And I would like especially the parents of cooperative, compliant teenagers to listen to this, because it's very possible to become very smug about your own kids if they seem to be turning out right, and to perhaps not realize the independence and the aggressiveness of teenagers whose very temperament takes them in the direction of sampling sin during these adolescent years. Maybe not because their parents have made mistakes or done things wrong, but because of their nature and because of their inclination to push and shove and test authority. And this is a mother who has a youngster who's done that. She said, your interview with Dr. John White was right on. I had already read Parents in Pain, so I knew what was going to be said, but I was glad to hear it again anyway. The spoken word often carries more impact than the same word written because of the emotions heard in the voice. We have two daughters, 19 and 20, raised as well as we could do it. I did the best I could to be a good example and to follow Christian standards. I spent hours trying to show them that each one was valued and loved immensely. I tried to give them room to be individuals, and we both enjoyed watching them develop into adults. In our zeal, we never even bought a television set. Results? We have one daughter who couldn't have turned out better, and one who couldn't have turned out worse. Our oldest daughter is a college graduate, has a productive job, is loving her Christian walk and is a joy to have around. Daughter number two caused us untold grief and worry, and finally, at the age of 18, ran off with a 29-year-old thrice-married man who was still married to wife number three.
Goodness sakes.
For 3 weeks, I sat at the kitchen table all day in shock. I didn't know that someone could endure that much pain and still live. At first, I thought I would commit suicide. Then I thought I would go around forever with failure branded on my forehead.
Now, let me interrupt you, because that's exactly the point White was making. She didn't run off with the 29-year-old, the mother who's writing this. She didn't do anything wrong, but we bear so much pain for the deeds of our children.
Yeah, the other side of that, Gil, is that maybe she has done things wrong. No one can be a perfect parent, and you can always point to your failures. You know, you can always find them. So even though you've done as good a job as anybody else would have done under those circumstances,
you feel like you failed.
You still feel like it's your fault, and you still internalize it.
Go on with the letter.
She said, "My husband and I had long discussions about whether we should drop out of church and not attempt to minister to others because of our failure.
Goodness.
It shook our marriage to the roots. We felt like 19 years was down the drain. It was so embarrassing to see people who knew what had happened. It was awful to see people who didn't know because they might ask how our girls are. I would cut people absolutely dead so that they wouldn't have a chance to ask. I complained to God for letting it happen. For many weeks I considered giving up the Christian walk, but on the other hand I could hardly wait for church and the Bible study because of the help I knew that was there. Finally, I did come to the point where I had to admit to God that I had to stick with Him because only He had the words of eternal life. But I could hardly pray for months because my heart was like a rock. Now, almost exactly 2 years have passed. We finally know where she is, and only this week she has decided that she would even write us a letter. There's a special group of parents at church who have formed an unspoken brotherhood because their children have broken their hearts, and other parents with all good kids lightly compare notes while the rest of us sit silently with aching hearts." Gil, that's a very important factor right there, you see. First of all, she's not alone. There are other parents out there that are silently dying inside, too. And those people need to be talking to one another. In any church of any size, there's more than one family in this same boat, and they need to be rowing together. I tell you, Dr. Dobson, that it would be easier to bury the children than it would be to see them using their bodies for such shameful purposes. Those bodies that we've lovingly washed, bandaged, dressed, stuffed good food and vitamins into, kept out of the lake and off the roads, and now they're using their lives to advance the cause of Satan. I sincerely hope that you, yourself, never hear your kids say, 'I hate you, you've ruined my life, and I never want to see you again,' and walk out coolly." I want to tell you something else about the effect that this has had on our family that we didn't expect. Our oldest daughter says, "I'll never have any children." Parents spend years doing their best for their kids, and suddenly, age 14 comes and the parents become despised enemies. I refuse to put up with that for myself. I could go on for several more paragraphs, but I think you get the idea, as much as you could not having gone through it yourself.
That's a painful, painful letter to listen to because, you know, I can't sit here and not think about my two girls who are pre-adolescent and think, you know, what's ahead? How do you anticipate? How do you even know what's going to happen?
Gil, she said in the last sentence there that she had explained it as best as possible to those of us who hadn't been through it. And I haven't been through it, but I've certainly seen it up close. And I've counseled parents who have sat in my office with a handkerchief, buried their face in their hands over this same issue. And I do know the agony that she's going through, and I think she said it beautifully.
Yeah.
And if she were only one parent speaking about one home, one problem, one situation, one daughter, then I wouldn't be inclined to give it this much attention. But there are an awful lot of people that are listening to me right now who have been through that private hell, and that's what it is. It is an agony. The thing you cared about more than anything else in the world. has gone to pieces, and there's not only this life at stake, but eternity at stake. That is awesome in its impact. And I do understand the complete despair that she expresses in this letter.
How in the world do you explain something like that? Here is a mother who couldn't have raised those two girls that differently. You know, she's the mother of the two girls.
Same philosophy with
both. But they are two different worlds apart. How do you explain it?
Well, it proves Dr. John White's point. Again, Gil, that parents don't control all the variables. Children are born with a basic temperament that operates independently of parental pressures. You know, you influence it in the early years, but ultimately that temperament will prevail. And trying to change that basic temperament is like trying to hold back the wind or the tides, because it's built into the computer, it's into the system. Secondly, parents don't control the environment that their children are growing up in. You control the environment in the home to some degree, but at 3, 4, 5 years of age, they walk out the front door, they meet friends, there are conversations that you wish they didn't have, there are experiences that you wish didn't occur, there's rejection, there are fights, there's influences, there's evil whispered in their ears, then they go off to school, and all day long things are going on there that are beyond your control. You don't control all those factors. And it does have an influence on the behavior and the personality of the child. Thirdly, and I've written a whole book on this subject, children are blessed with a free will, after all, and they are free to exercise it. And you can, again, shape that will, and you can influence it in the early years, but ultimately, in late adolescence and in the early teens, that will prevail, and that child will choose. And you can no more take away that free choice than God took it away from Adam and Eve. It is there. Now, it is my opinion, Gil, that these three factors, the will of the child, the basic temperament of the child, and the outside environment, probably outweigh your own influence as a parent. Now, that being the case, it is not reasonable that I should take the blame for everything that my child does.
I was going to say that. That speaks to parental guilt, doesn't it? I am not necessarily responsible for every decision, every behavior of my child.
I am absolutely convinced that guilt is often unjustified at this point. God wasn't responsible for Adam's sin, yet God was the perfect father, and Adam and Eve chose to do wrong. They had a free will, free choice, and they chose what was wrong. That wasn't God's fault. There's no, you know, theologically, there's no way to make that God's fault. By the same token, was the difference between Cain and Abel attributable to the way that they were raised by Adam and Eve? You know, one of them became loved of God and a servant of God. The other one became a murderer. Is there any indication that it was Adam and Eve's fault? The Bible doesn't say that.
That's beautifully stated, and those biblical illustrations have tremendous power to them. They're not often preached from that aspect, are they? We search for other truths which are there. But
I find it throughout the Bible, Gil, that free choice is emphasized, that we are, after all, free moral agents, and God does permit us to make those decisions, and that means that I cannot take away the right to make that choice by my child.
All right, Doctor, the letter you read just a few moments ago was very troubling, and I know you feel for that mother and others like her. Can we close today just with a quick word of encouragement for parents who are suffering that kind of anguish, maybe over a son or a daughter who's made some wrong decisions or gone the wrong way?
First of all, I'd like to say to the mother who wrote this letter that the ball game is not over. Don't forget, this is maybe the 6th inning, 7th inning, maybe it's only the 3rd inning. And if God permits, there may be 30, 40, 50 years of life yet for that young person. And God has ways of getting through to him. And Gil, I know that God cares about that matter. And I've seen him turn absolute tragedy into triumph and chaos into order and peacefulness. And I just pray today for the parent that wrote this letter and all the others that so desperately need a touch from God today, that they'll be given a new hope, that he does understand, that he is involved, and the outcome is in his hands.
And on that note, let me mention that you've been listening to Conversation from a Focus on the Family radio broadcast, in which our host, psychologist Dr. James Dobson, was talking with me about some letters that he'd received from parents of teenagers and offering a little advice on providing leadership to adolescents.